Blog Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Hello, world. This is David Van Nuys, PhD, otherwise known as Dr. Dave. And I'm here with my co-host, I hope, Jerry Trumbull. Jerry, are you here?
I hope so, Dave. Am I here?
I think you're here. You're in my head.
All right. Good.
At the very least. I guess I should just say, first of all, apologies to regular Shrink Wrap Radio listeners to whom for the past 2 weeks I've announced that we would be on at 9 a.m. Pacific time. And evidently, once again, I probably made a mistake in setting this up and discovered this morning that, in fact, we're starting out at 10 a.m. Pacific time. And in case anybody's tuned in who hasn't heard us here before, I should mention that Shrink Wrap Radio is a regular weekly podcast that can be found at podshow.com or also on iTunes or at www.shrinkwrapradio.com. And the format is generally a show that runs about an hour in which I interview psychologists and others from around the broad world of psychology, personal growth, spirituality, and so on. But from time to time, about once a month, I get together here with my good friend Jerry Trumbull for what we call Shrink Wrap Radio Live, in which we hope there are listeners who will call in or join us in the chat room. Whew, how's that for an intro, Jerry?
Not bad, given that we started about 30 seconds before airtime.
Oh, no. I Blog Talk Radio told me that it was time to go, so.
No, I mean, we started setting up. I was online waiting for you to come on Skype, and nothing was happening, so I got off and got back on again, and I guess we're okay now.
Yeah, well, I was in a panic. I was behind the eight ball. I was doing some other things, and time got away from me, and then I realized, oh, my goodness, it's just a few minutes before we're supposed to be on the air, and I've got to start setting things up. And as a matter of fact, it seems like this is working fine. I am calling in through Skype as well, and generally Skype doesn't work great if you've got a lot of stuff running in the background, and in fact, I went out and bought a new 1 terabyte backup hard drive yesterday. Can you believe that? A terabyte in a box.
Oh, my gosh. You've really launched yourself into the future now, Dave.
Yeah. For $250 at Costco, you can get a terabyte, which, you know, maybe as recently as 10 years ago, that would have seemed mind-bogglingly impossible. Even a year ago, I mean, you couldn't have bought that.
No, it's coming faster than we can keep up with it. Now, I thought you already had a terabyte. Is this a second terabyte?
Yeah, I'm afraid it is.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I had 2 half-terabyte drives, and the deal was just so great that I thought, well, I need to get one of these terabyte drives. And so that was a preamble to the fact that that drive is being backed up right now from the computer. So if we experience any degradation of my chat, I should probably turn off the backup. So you just let me know if I need to do that.
You sound fine. I don't notice anything, so I'd say keep it running until it starts to happen.
Yeah, okay, that's sort of what I decided to do as well. Okay, I don't see anybody in the chat room, and I don't see any callers. It's easy to miss people who are waiting to call in, but I don't see that. We had announced that we were going to talk about communication because there were a couple of amazing things. You have a blog that you call Astounding News.
Right.
Yeah, and there has been some astounding news lately that's caught your eye and my eye. And even a more recent thing that I just turned you onto this morning before this talk that I wanted to squeeze in. And maybe it's not so much about communication as it is about the amazing brain. I think that's the thing that ties all three of these things together.
Yes, indeed. In fact, I was doing a little research a few minutes ago, and I was reading about the gentleman who had created the blue brain. I don't know if we want to start with that, but one of the things he said was that at one point he was monitoring the activity of a single neuron, and he witnessed it communicating with another neuron, and that for him was kind of a breakthrough. Why couldn't he simulate all sorts of neurons hooking up with each other, endow them with the properties that he could determine from the biological neuron, put it into the computer simulation, and attempt to recreate what they call a neocortical column? That is to say, not the whole brain, but just one small portion, starting with the neocortex at the top and then simulating the cells below it, which apparently form the incredibly complex nexus, plexus, whatever you want to call it, of literally millions of cells below each of these columns. I don't think the columns are discrete, but it's just a way to start in on the problem. And he's done that, and you can look it up with Blue Brain. Just Google that, and you'll find all sorts of interesting things. But when I sent you that that reference, I titled it Finally, because it's really what I've been waiting for all my life. I had hoped to be a participant in this simulation of the brain, but things didn't work out that way. But I've continued to follow it, and it looks to me like we're getting close. This giant IBM computer is now trying to simulate, or is simulating, a neocortical column from a two-week-old rat brain. And some might quibble with the starting point there with the rat brain, but these structures are similar across the mammalian group. And so we can learn a lot by studying a rat brain.
Well, I knew this was ringing a bell, so thank you for reminding me that you sent me a link and that's where I found out about it. I was frantically searching my own brain, saying, did I read about that in the newspaper? Did I read about that in Wired magazine? And I knew it was ringing a bell, and I guess it was the link that you sent me. But I think I did actually later encounter a story about it in the newspaper somewhere, or multiple sources, because it is a major development.
Yes, it is indeed. In fact, if you go to their site, you'll find all kinds of interesting little animations, I guess they are, but they're movies of, for example, flying around inside of this neuronal column. And the wonderful thing about this, and something that had escaped me and my thoughts about this, when I first got into computers, I, of course, like everybody else, I said, well, this is kind of like a little junior brain here, but the problem is the transistors have two states off and on, 0 and 1, and the neurons that we're trying to study have many states. Some neurons have 7 or 8 different states that they can go into as far as their communication with other neurons. And so how are we ever going to do that? Well, of course, I was not informed about the world of computer simulation. So basically, we can make our two-state transistors simulate anything we want. And in this case, we're simulating neurons that operate on their own to form their own connections. And to me, that's like, wow, this is the beginning. We're going to finally understand the brain.
Yes. Now, I sent you a link to a presentation by Craig Vintor, the fellow who mapped the human genome. And now I'm having difficulty recalling exactly what I was so excited about, but I think it was something similar. Isn't he working on developing... Now it comes back to me. He's got another project now in which he's working on developing life pretty much from scratch. So that's just a little bit tangential to what we're talking about, though not totally unrelated, but some really fascinating work there. But rather than go down that little white rat alley of a maze.
Right.
Yeah. Let me segue us to this most recent source of excitement for me, which was a video that I found on the internet. There's this wonderful series called TED that can be found at TED.com. And TED stands for Technology Entertainment Design. And it's a series in which they approach the leading thinkers of the day. I don't know why they haven't knocked at our door yet, but they approach the leading thinkers of the day and challenge them to give the best 18-minute presentation of their life. And so that's where I saw Craig Vintor, and more recently, the one that I sent you a link this morning about Jill Bolt Taylor. I don't know if the middle name is pronounced Bolt or Bolte. It's B-O-L-T-E. And she does a presentation. I think her presentation was about 18 minutes, 19 minutes. And it really blew my mind. She is a neuroscientist. She has a PhD in some branch of neuroscience. You might recall better than I do that part. And she already had this degree, and she was already working as an educator, going around the country, educating people about the brain. And one morning, she had a stroke in her left hemisphere, which kind of knocked out the left hemisphere and meant that she could only function with the right hemisphere of her brain. And this led to a totally different way of experiencing herself, her body, her mind, her thoughts, and external reality. And the mode that she described of perception was one of being aware of energy, of a loss of boundaries, that things seemed to flow into one another, that she felt huge and expansive and connected to everything. What got me so excited and interested was it sounded like she was describing an enlightenment kind of experiment. And so I suddenly had this take on meditation, the exercise of meditation where they talk about turning off the chatter, as being a technique that has evolved for suppressing the left hemisphere and allowing the right hemisphere to emerge. What do you think about that, Jerry?
Well, yeah. In fact, thanks for turning me on to that TED presentation. It's a great site just to while away the hours. But I was very moved by her discussion of what it felt like on the inside while she was going through this stroke. And it recalled to my mind thoughts that I had years ago about whether it was possible to study your own mind from the inside, or whether you would be constantly deluded into thinking that you were thinking things that you weren't really thinking. In other words, could you get down to some structural level in your own brain? And it sounds to me like that's what she did. Not by choice, of course, but She did describe, and she took a model or an actual human brain out on stage and showed the two halves, the two hemispheres, and it made me think about 1970 when the exploration of the two halves of the brain separately first got underway. Do you remember that? The left and right brain, there was all this talk that came out about...
Right, and people still use it as a metaphor. Lots of New Agers will talk about left brain, right brain in ways that I sometimes get uncomfortable with because I think they're doing it very sort of metaphorically, and I think the situation is probably a lot more complex than it's usually portrayed.
Yeah, I agree with that. The thing I always, back in the 60s, even before that, when I was in school, we were pretty much taught that the two halves of the brain functioned in the same way, and they were there at one, it was kind of a backup system, like your terabyte drive. It was kind of like you got this extra one here just in case something goes wrong with the first one, you can use the backup one. And in fact, the doctor that I was studying under, Dr. Philip Teitelbaum, he was very much into the study of how a functionality could be taken up by the other half of the brain in the case of some damage to one half or the other. In other words, people could relearn how to walk and talk after a stroke in a way that made it seem like, oh, okay, now we're switching to the other one and we're just using the backup capabilities. But I never really bought into that. I'm always suspicious when people tell me that some part of my body is not really functioning and it's just there as a backup or perhaps a gland or an organ that used to be used and is no longer really needed. The pineal gland in particular, they said that about. So I never really believed that the two halves of the brain were just duplicative and you know, we were just in case we got hit on one side, and the fact that it was crossed over to the lateral, the other side, was another built-in protection so that we wouldn't be totally, if we got smashed on one side, we'd still be able to kind of crawl around a little bit. And the corpus callosum, the magic bridge between the two halves, that, you know, what was going on there? Well, back in 1970, we didn't have a clue. But it sounds to me like we're getting some very good clues now.
Oh, yes.
And from her description, which it actually brought tears to my eyes, the idea of this liberated right brain, where she said she felt all this energy flowing in, she couldn't discriminate herself from her surround, and she became enormous. And it sounds to me like she was expanding into the universe. You know, it's kind of a magical, mystical thought. You know?
Yeah, well, it's exactly what, you know, longtime meditators describe as Satori or a Nirvana enlightenment kind of experience. And that's what really grabbed my attention, having read so many of those accounts.
Yeah, she even talks about the chatter disappearing, her left brain, which she describes as a linear, serial, connecting past and present, and that the chatter comes from that side, and her chatter was fading in and out, I guess as a function of her stroke. And without that left brain, but she talks about the difficulty of dialing the phone number. It took her a long time to find her own card so she could find the phone number to phone in the work. I don't know why she didn't think of 911, but maybe that was coming from the left brain. The right brain couldn't remember 911. But she couldn't even distinguish the numbers. She talked about seeing the pixels, but they weren't numbers. So she had to cover up. She would look at one number and then she would try to find something similar on the phone pad, And then when she hit that number, then she would have to cover up that number on the card so she would know that she had already dialed it.
Yes. Now, listeners, really, in order to really understand what we're talking about, you're going to have to go look at this video. Not now, although you can pause this, I suppose, and come back to it. But you will find it at TED.com. That's just TED.com. And if you click to their presentations, right now there's a big picture of her. She's kind of the most recent one, I guess. She also, and then watch that video because it is simply astounding. And she also has a website, and I'm thinking I'm going to try to get her as a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, so, that'd be great.
Yeah, because she does speaking. She has a book, it turns out, in which she describes the whole experience. She also she has products. She has, on her website, she has stained glass creations, I guess, that she has made of the brain. She has embroidered shirts and so on with brain images on them. And it shows, her website says Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, the singing scientist. And there is a picture of her with a guitar. Now, she didn't sing in the video that we saw, but it would be easy enough to imagine her singing because it was delivered with a kind of lyrical passion and really with a sort of call to action, where she seemed to be saying, you know, step into the right side of your brain, cultivate the right side of your brain. If we were all to do that, we would experience world peace, which again sounds very much like the whole mystical meditative tradition speaking there. And it gave the impression that as a result of this stroke, and I would love to ask her this, it gave me the impression that maybe she's able to move back and forth between these two states somewhat at will now. Did you get that impression?
Yeah. In fact, I began to wonder, okay, great. Now tell me how to do this
short
of having a stroke. I don't really want to go that far, but can you give us some practical hints here that would enable us to switch between the two sides? Because I don't know about you, but I've never been able to shut up the chatter, left brain side, except by going to sleep. And then it's chattering away in my dreams. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Ah, grasshopper, 30 years of meditation. That's the answer.
Really?
Yeah.
So do you believe that some of the existing techniques could be scanned to prove that indeed that is what's happening? Is there anything along that line?
Well, I don't know. I would assume that somebody is doing that research. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a podcast interview tomorrow with a meditation teacher, one of the foremost teachers of meditation in this country, whose name is Shinzen Young, and very interesting fellow who, when he was a teenager growing up in Los Angeles, as a result of seeing a samurai movie, decided to learn Japanese. And he insisted that his parents put him in a Japanese high school, which evidently there was one in L.A., if I have the story right. I'm not sure that I'm 100% correct here. And this led to him going to Japan, studying for many years, actually becoming a Zen monk, studying, I think, at several monasteries, and then returning to this country. And he's been, I guess, one of the foremost people working at extrapolating meditative practices from the East into formats that Westerners that are really adapted to Western life.
Wow, that sounds good.
And evidently, he spent a lot of his time reconciling science and meditation and looking at that literature. So this, I want to send him a link to this and get his take on it. And yeah, I did, if I had the tools, if I had the what is it, the functional
MRI.
Yeah,
the
fMRI, if I had access to that, I would really want to explore this hypothesis among, you know, really advanced meditators to see if in fact their right hemisphere was more activated than the left.
Yeah, that would certainly kind of verify some of this, that some of these findings, because once again, you know, she may have had a subjective experience that led her to believe that she was doing left brain, right brain things, and it might have been totally false.
Yeah, except that this hemorrhage created a something, I don't know what you would call it, in her brain, this, on the left side, the size of a golf ball that had to be removed.
Right, right. Hematoma.
Yeah, there you go. So that suggests, you know, that is a bit of something objective about, yes, there was a problem on the left and then something on the right.
And, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know about a lot, but there is some research on the so-called split brain preparation. I think there was a time when they actually cut the corpus callosum as a method of trying to stop epilepsy, or I'm not sure what it was used for.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, that's going back to what you were talking about in the 70s when we began to have this kind of explosion of information, and we began to get the characterization of the two hemispheres. In the right hemisphere, my recollection is that the left hemisphere was characterized as primarily verbal, logical, sequential, temporal, whereas the right hemisphere was sort of more the creative, diffuse, abstract, you know, not concrete, not sequential, more associative side of our thinking, and that both are required in for ordinary, you know, for navigating the world as a fully competent human being.
Mm-hmm.
Which maybe is a good segue into one of the other things that we wanted to talk about, because I know we have at least two more on our to-do list here, which is this video. Did you turn me on to it, or did I turn you on to it? I can't remember, about Amanda Bags.
I think you may have gotten it from more than one source. I sent you a link to the YouTube video because I'm really into YouTube, and I can't even remember where I found it, but it was an incredible 7 or 8 minutes, I think, of Amanda, who is autistic, making a movie of herself. It starts with her standing in front of her window, swinging her hands around, doing what could probably be called a dance of some kind, and she's kind of humming a little bit. The first thing I noticed was that the camera angle was kind of high and behind her, and so she had supposedly made this video herself, and I began to doubt that. But I was really intrigued by what was going on, because about halfway through, she switches into a different mode. Apparently, she can type at about 120 words per minute, and she has a synthetic voice that reads her typing. And here she was now communicating with us in a very sophisticated, very large vocabulary type,
extremely literate type vocabulary.
Yeah, and I was going like, "What? Wait a minute now." Is this, and her point, which was once again very, I found it to be a very emotional experience. Her point was that she was just as well off inside of her head, communicating with her environment in a way that we, as, quote, normals, could not even appreciate. And as a result of that, not only were we missing the boat with so-called autistic people, but we were actually imprisoning them and mistreating them. In fact, they were living in their own world and communicating in their own way, and everything was pretty good on the inside. And then we were trying to force them into all these other things that they found to be really stupid. She, for example, she says, "Why is it that I have to communicate in your language and you make no effort to communicate in my language? In fact, the piece is called In My Language." And you pointed out to me that an article had just appeared in Wired magazine about this young lady, and I just happened to have that particular issue here at my desk. And
so do I. I have it open at the moment. It's the March issue of Wired magazine, 2008.
And the amazing thing about it is that I'm assuming that Wired vetted all of this and determined that it really was her doing the typing that produced the synthetic language and not some scam, because you're always wondering, should you believe what you see on the internet, you know, how that is.
Yeah, well, when I first saw the video, that was, you know, my first reaction was, wow, that is really amazing. And then after a little time went by, like 2 or 3 minutes, I immediately sort of drifted off to, this has got to be a scam. Wait a second. Nobody could write in that literate a sort of voice unless they were a major reader. And the person that I just saw in this video, you know, looked like a sort of, to colloquially, you know, a headbanger, if you will, with hair going down over her eyes and arms swinging back and forth. And, you know, it doesn't look like somebody who could even hold or focus in on a book. So it just seemed to me preposterous. But then I discovered that there was this full-on article, starts on page 164 in March Wired. And having looked through the article again, I have to say that I do believe that the author of the article met her, saw it all taking place in person, and is fully persuaded that it's not a scam.
Yeah, I came to the same conclusion. I would certainly like to see more. I kept, being a videographer, I kept looking at the camera angles, the cuts, the titles, sophisticated titles that are on at the beginning. And I kept saying, wow, this is a professional job here. Now, did somebody help her put this together? Did she use the editing equipment on the video with her own camera? And apparently that's the case.
Yeah, that's what she says, that she did it all herself. And mm-hmm. that actually, I think she took the actual video was done with just, you know, a point-and-shoot digital camera that could take burst video.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which,
yeah,
I've used myself on occasion.
Yeah, so I have to take it at face value. And I don't know if people who are working in the field spend much time looking at YouTube, but it seems to me that anyone who deals with autistic people or people with any sort of so-called disability, her claim is that it's not really a disability, you know, that it's just different.
She says, we're weird, get used to it.
mm-hmm.
You know, kind of like gay, she likens it to gay pride. And she mm-hmm. says, you know, we're weird, we're here, get used to it.
Yeah.
I spoke to a colleague. There was a psychology faculty party that I went to recently, Sonoma State University. And one of my colleagues has a severely developmentally impaired child. I don't know if she's considered to be autistic. I'm not sure what the diagnosis is, but I know that my colleague does a lot of work in autism. And she said her concern about these things is that there are these examples that one finds here and there of autistic people with extraordinary capabilities, and her concern is that it pulls away from the awareness that there are big problems here that need to be dealt with, and I guess she worries that funding might disappear, et cetera. So that was a different take on it than I had.
Yeah, my only relevant experience came from a time when I was a plumber. I actually taught myself how to do plumbing because I had purchased a building that needed a lot of plumbing done. And then I started hiring out with my brother, my younger brother, and we got a contract to take care of a group home. And so we went there to see what needed to be done. And they had about, I think, 7 or 8 residents, all of whom were autistic. And our job was to go there once a week and see what needed to be repaired, because they were always breaking things, like windows and doors, and there was a lot of incidental damage going on. So we had a full-time deal to go there once a week, see what needed to be done, and then do it. And so we would be there working when the kids came home from school, and we got to know them as individuals. Some of them were pretty highly functioning. They would go off to their special school every day. And you could carry on a good conversation with them. And the first thing that my brother and I learned is that they had a wry sense of humor. There were two in particular that seemed to always want to be playing jokes and laughing, doing things that they thought were funny. And we started getting into it with them. there was, for example, the one young guy, I guess he was about 16, 17 years old, loved to mop. He loved to mop the floor. So they would give him a bucket and an old-fashioned mop, but no water. And so he would go around the place, the linoleum, and he would be acting like he was mopping. And so we said to him, what are you doing? He said, I'm mopping. And we said, well, how come you don't have any water in your bucket? And he looked at the bucket, and he said, well, they don't let me have water. And we said, well, golly, you can't really mop if you don't have water, can you? So we encouraged him to go fill up his bucket with water, which he did, and then he proceeded to do some real mopping. And then, of course, that was against the rules, and we had to intervene to keep him from getting in trouble, but he really enjoyed stuff like that, and we kind of got to know him, you know, personally from being there repeatedly. And I was thinking, wow, these kids, you know, they obviously have some difficulty, but their brains are working pretty well on different things. And that's what I came away with from that experience. But it seems to me that this young lady kind of demonstrates that point, and maybe we should be teaching autistic people how to type.
Well, you know, that's an interesting comment, because it brings back to mind an earlier enthusiasm that I went through, that a number of us went through, where there were reports that, and I believe it was autistic people, that if their caretakers held their hands over a keyboard, that they would type these really profound things. And so there were a bunch of, it created a big stir in psychological circles, and there were studies done, and being the internet maven that you are, maybe you'll track this down, and it was concluded that the caretakers were subtly influencing these people's hands, and that they somehow are causing all of this intelligent output to happen. Now, this case of Amanda Bags, though, maybe brings that, you know, raises that question again and suggests that, well, wait a second, maybe that was dismissed too quickly.
Well, from all everything we can see and from what we can read, it appears that she's actually doing the typing. There's no Ouija board thing going on there with somebody directing her hands. But I just found it totally astounding, and I wanted to call up some autistic people and ask them if I could bring a computer over so they could start typing.
Well, you know, it mentions in the article that her favorite pastime is interacting with other people who have autism or Asperger's in Second Life and on certain discussion boards. So maybe you can find your way into one of those spaces and do a little interview.
And the Second Life connection is just totally mind-boggling when you think about it, that a person in that category would be able to go on to Second Life, assume a whole different external avatar type.
I would love to see what her avatar looks like.
Yeah, me too.
I was recently exploring Second Life, not directly going on to it, but looking for YouTube videos and particularly looking into internet addiction and Second Life addiction. I got to give a presentation this next week, and I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do as a guest shot in somebody's psychology class, and I wanted to do something around the internet, so that's why I was poking around in that area. And I saw a really interesting British, I think it was a set of videos from a British series on internet addiction, Second Life addiction. Very interesting story about this husband-wife, and the husband was really upset because his wife seemed to be totally addicted to YouTube and this adulterous fantasy relationship that she developed on Second Life. And so it was amazing to see this avatar that she had. That was really fascinating to me, was both to see her avatar and her fantasy lover's avatar, this actual guy, you know, who she had not physically met, but they were meeting on the internet. But you got to see what they both look like in real life. And they had these wonderfully idealized fantasy portrayals of themselves. And evidently it's the case in general that in Second Life, people make themselves better looking, taller, stronger, handsomer, prettier, more magical in every way than they are in real life.
Well, as you know, I joined Second Life early on, got into it, checked it out, and I have a question. How come you haven't joined yet?
You know, I flirt with it every now and then, partly because of the report that you gave me where you said that it was slow and clunky, I think. Didn't you tell me that?
Well, not really. I mean, at the beginning, they did have, every time you would go there once a day, there would be a new version to download, which you had to do in its entirety before you could get going. But I never found that to be a big problem. I went through a whole series of self-examination myself when I had to create my avatar. And I did pretty much what you described. I made kind of an idealized version of my real self. You know, you only have generalized tools, so you can't, at least currently, you can't make it look exactly like yourself. But, of course, I did slim my gut down a little bit and make my hair slick back a little bit better. But but then when I was actually in there walking around and stuff, I found I was extremely shy about going up to other people and starting a conversation. But occasionally it would happen almost accidentally. I would be sitting on a bench. This is one episode. I was sitting on a bench just watching other people, lurking, as it were. And this one nice-looking woman came and sat down next to me. And at the time, I was trying to learn about the financial aspects of Second Life. It has its own currency, the Linden, and it's exchangeable in dollars. So it's kind of like the currency of another country.
A few people have made fortunes there already.
Yes,
that they were able to convert to dollar fortunes.
Exactly. And there's real estate and transactions, and my partner and I are into the stock market and taking small companies public. So we began to wonder if there was going to be a stock market on Second Life. I can tell you now that there are two stock markets on Second Life, and there's been all kinds of problems, very interesting parallels to real life. But this woman that sat down next to me, I just started to chat with her, and I just out of the blue, I asked her if she knew anything about the Second Life stock market, and she knew everything about the Second Life stock market. So we struck up this great conversation. And, of course, I'm looking at my screen, and it's all done with typing, although they say they're going to have voice capabilities soon. So on the screen, when you are conversing, your hands are out in the air doing a kind of a typing pantomime. So then I noticed that she seems not to be paying attention to me on the screen, right?
Yeah.
She's looking off in the distance to the left of me.
Is she looking at some other avatar?
Yeah. So I'm sitting there talking, and she's looking at this really handsome young guy.
Just like real life.
Yeah, exactly. And I, noticing that I had kind of lost her attention, I stopped typing, and I just kind of watched. And she got up and went off with the other guy. I had no bond to her, but I was going to ask her if I could be her friend, which you can do, and that way you can find them more easily later on. But I didn't even get a chance to ask her if she would be my friend. So I felt totally crushed.
Yeah, I can understand that.
I signed off.
Well, you know, it's a good question. Why hasn't Dr. Dave gone on Second Life? Because from my profile, one would expect that I would.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess partly it's just I'm a little nervous about getting sucked into it, that I'm so busy in my first life, I just don't see how I'd have the time. But I did, yesterday on my walk, I was having a fantasy of hiring somebody to jumpstart me in Second Life, you know, getting on Craigslist and hiring somebody to come up and give me some hands-on instruction and help me create a really cool-looking avatar. And as you know, I'm involved in market research, and I'm going to be moderating a panel in Barcelona in May at an international market research convention. Conference would be a better word, not convention. And one of the people that I'm going to be introducing there actually runs a market research facility in Second Life. Color me jealous. You know, I should have done that.
I told you.
Yeah, so he's got a facility there, and they just kind of grab people in Second Life. Hey, how would you like to be in the market research discussion? And they built a little facility there with a one-way mirror and the comfy chairs and the avatars sitting in the chairs, and they have a whole market research talk, and then they can pay them in Linden dollars and so on.
Yes,
so there is, yeah.
I was going to say, as you'll recall, I was encouraging you to take Shrink Wrap Radio into Second Life.
Yes, and I do recall that.
And then I found some evidence that psychologists were making their way in. This is over a year ago, I guess. And I'll tell you the truth, I haven't been back that often. I have enough things in real life to make me feel bad about getting rejected. So I don't need to seek out rejection. And then the other thing is, actually, one time I induced my granddaughter, who was she was 18 at the time. I said, "Well, you go on Second Life, and then I'll go on, and we'll prearrange a place to meet," which we did. And it was quite interesting because her avatar was nothing like her. But we did eventually find each other, and we found it very difficult to interact, to walk together, for example, or to fly together. Flying together was almost impossible because you would lose sight of the person and you wouldn't know whether they were above or below you. But we only did it one time, and it wasn't very satisfying. And perhaps I haven't really gotten comfortable in Second Life yet. I think you could say that. But it's gotten so weird in there Because, you know, the way it works and the way the Linden Corporation makes a lot of money is they charge for uploading scripts. You can program your own little scripts, and then you have to pay, I think, $10, it used to be, to upload them into Second Life, and where you can then use them. And you can even sell them. And there are now companies that do nothing but generate these scripts for sale that you can then take up to Second Life and put them in. So they do things that in those scripts that the originators of the program probably never dreamed of. I was sitting on a park bench at one of the places where the newbies arrive, and all of a sudden a giant, I mean, I couldn't see how tall the guy was, but I only saw his foot. His foot was enormous. It was like 15 feet long, and it came crashing across the landscape. And then I saw, at the same episode, I saw two creatures of unknown origin doing what was obviously copulating right out in the square there. And that was too weird to even contemplate. And what's more, I thought that that was outlawed, but apparently not. I got turned in one time for accidentally bumping into somebody. They reported me as if I had attacked them or something, and I hadn't even seen them, and that was kind of disturbing. But it's exciting, and I can definitely see why people get heavily into it. I mean, a lot of the things from First Life are being transformed into Second Life, especially this entrepreneurial money-making possibility.
You know, speaking of the evolution that's gone on there, I saw a series of video clips. Evidently, there was some flap about a suicide bomber in Second Life, and I was able to see clips of an avatar with a suicide bomber belt, and she was walking in public spaces. And I don't know if she actually managed to blow herself up there and destroy other avatars or just what the whole deal was. But I gather that was a bit troubling to people in Second Life, and that person may have gotten kicked off. I'm not sure.
Well, in Second Life, there is a place, I've forgotten what it's called, but it's like it's a separate island, where you can go register and take some classes, and then you are turned loose into this interior world where violence is okay. And you can buy different kinds of guns, and you can go around shooting people. And you yourself can actually get killed, which makes you unavailable for a certain period of time, and then you're back again. And I've never gone inside of there, because out in the rest of Second Life, there's not supposed to be any violence or there's no guns or anything like that. But apparently, from what you say, that didn't work completely.
Yeah, I don't have a very full understanding of what was going on. Now, when I was watching this British show about this woman who, you know, was where it was wrecking her marriage because she was so caught up with this fantasy lover in Second Life, looked like she was wearing a headset with a microphone and she was talking to somebody. Now, I was under the impression that all the communication in Second Life is done via text, but I suppose once you hook up with somebody, maybe you could set up an arrangement to be talking to each other in Skype. I wonder if that's what was going on.
I don't know, because I haven't been there for quite some time, but I do recall that they were talking about introducing voice capability into Second Life. Now, this would be, I don't know exactly how it would work, because if you're sitting in the square, you get to see the text from all the different people that are talking. So if that were transformed into sound, it would be cacophony. I mean, there would be a lot of different voices. But maybe you'd have to go away some distance to talk to somebody.
Or maybe there's a button you click on to engage in voice with a specific person.
Yeah, they do have a built-in IM kind of a thing, or they did, and maybe they've turned that into an actual audio connection. That would be even scarier, Dave.
Well, I'm going to keep thinking about it. I don't know. Well, we've got another 5 minutes remaining, and we haven't talked about this National Geographic article also in March. What a month March has been already.
With, really?
These really thought-provoking scientific breakthroughs and internet videos and so on. And the March National Geographic, the cover story is Inside Animal Minds. We've talked about some of this before, about the capabilities of the brains of animals and the fact that, as with the autistic people that we were talking about, of sort of unknown capabilities that most of us don't recognize are there, that there's more and more good science suggesting that animals are capable of much more sophisticated reasoning than most of us have dreamed.
Yes, in fact, that brings me back to my, I don't know even what to call it, but in the years of learning and studying, and I keep coming to the conclusion that as humans, we are constantly making the same mistake over and over again, way back beginning of our history, mm-hmm. of assuming that we are the center of the universe, that we know what we're doing, we can talk, we can write, and that everything else is kind of a lesser being. And we're discovering, I think, what you're pointing out is evidence that, no, other organisms who have been evolving along with us for millions of years, they just didn't stop at a stupid stage. They continued, it's kind of like, oh, we're on the top of the scale here. Nobody else can really talk. Tool use, for example, which we always used as the way to separate us from the animals. Now they discover all kinds of tool use among primates and even other, even insects, for example, have all kinds of tools they build and use for themselves. And indeed, as you were saying, they have all kinds of language that they're engaging in. And we've just been ignorant, going like, oh yeah, the dog's barking. not realizing that a particular set of four barks with a howl, it means something very complex, and we're too stupid to get it.
Yeah, well, just to give some examples in the little time that we have left here, the picture on the cover shows a border collie, and this particular border collie has a vocabulary, a working vocabulary of 340 words.
Wow.
So that's 340 different commands that it can respond to. They have a story here about a sheep. Evidently, sheep are good at recognizing faces, and I guess they've run tests on this one particular sheep who can distinguish 50 different sheep faces individually, as well as 15 different human faces that it can distinguish between. They talk about Irene Pepperberg's research with Alex, the parrot, and I believe you knew Irene Pepperberg, is that right?
Not personally, only indirectly through my daughter-in-law, but she had worked with Dr. Pepperberg and got me a copy of her new book and asked me to read it. Read it with a critical eye, and I think you and I discussed it back then, but basically her research requires the use of an unusual paradigm.
We are in our last minute. I just have to say, I'll let you keep talking, but it's all in your mind.
No, it's not, Dave. There's reality out there. I know there is. I can feel it. I can touch it.
Okay.
No, I agree. It's all in somebody's mind.
58 seconds remaining. 55.
Well, it's good that we were able to communicate. I don't know if we communicated to anyone else other than ourselves, but hopefully it'll get a few listens and maybe even generate some comments. I noticed that some of our other shows were good at generating comments on shrinkwrapradio.com.
Yes, and we love to see those comments. We will definitely hope that there'll be some comments there. And, you know, it seems like not that many people catch this show live, but I put it on the regular Shrink Wrap Radio feed and so that everybody can hear it.
Great.
And so that's how we've gotten a lot of our comments. Now, there is somebody in the room just now. I think it says Jeffy. So, hi, Jeffy. And we had Adam here, and I sent Adam a chat, you know, saying, hey, Adam. And I guess he's tech support, and he was just dropping by to make sure that everything was working okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I guess we're off now. I have a message that says, show is on but not streaming.
Okay.
So I'm going to hang up the this could still be getting recorded here. So I'm going to say goodbye, and then you and I can talk on Skype.
Okay, Dave.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.